I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. In our first hour, three people striving to make life better for others. Arthur Morgan, the energetic community activist who gathers unsold food and redistributes it to low-income families in Baltimore. Artist and photographer Lynn Casaubon, who collaborated with inmates at the women's prison in Jessup, getting them to not only build gardens on the prison grounds, but to see the gardens as self-portraits. Lynn will be here to explain. But first, we hear from Tyler Maines, a Hopkins medical student, encouraging Baltimore high school students to consider careers in health sciences, connecting them with internships and mentors in the medical field, giving them a head start before college. Midday Friday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Midday's best books of 2014. That's in the second hour of our show. It's that time of year when we look back on some of the books we featured on Midday during the past year and some of the fiction that we didn't feature. But Paula Gallagher, who reviews books and is with the Baltimore County Public Library System, she's going to be with us to talk about fiction, her favorite books of the past year, what she considered the best books of 2014, and Michael Himowitz, Midday Associate Producer, who works on all of our shows, many of our shows, in which I interview authors, the books that we feature on the show during the course of the year. Mike will be here to talk about some of his favorite books of 2014, and you can join us too. In fact, you can do that right now. Send us an email if there's a book title, new or old, a book you read in 2014 that you really liked and want to mention to our audience. Go ahead and send us an email, and I'll read it during the second hour of the show today, midday@wypr.org, or use social media. Go to my Facebook page. You can post a title there. Tell us what you liked about a book. Don't just give the title. If you can, just say what you liked about it. And you can also do that on Twitter at @midday_WYPR or Dan Rodericks. Find me on Twitter that way as well. Today, in the first hour, we hear from three people all trying to better the lives of others. We'll hear from a community activist and former Open Society Institute fellow, Arthur Morgan, who gathers food that would otherwise go to waste, and he gets it to families in need in Baltimore City. We'll also talk to a multimedia artist who is connecting incarcerated women to nature while they're behind bars at the women's prison in Jessup. But first, we have Johns Hopkins medical student who's with us. He and his colleagues trying to encourage Baltimore high school students to pursue careers in health sciences, maybe even become doctors. His name is Tyler Maines, joining us here in Studio A. Tyler Maines is one of the founders of MERIT, M-E-R-I-T, that stands for Medical Education Resources Initiative for Teens, which supports high school students in Baltimore who want to pursue careers in medicine. They get Saturday sessions, they get mentorship, they get internships. Tyler Maines, welcome to the show. Nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So you're trying to get kids who aren't that much younger than you to do what you're doing, which is pursue maybe medical career, right? Medical school.
Yeah, and not just medical school, but any career in health
science.
Right.
Generally health sciences, that covers a lot of ground, right?
Yeah.
So let's go over this a little bit. How old are you, Tyler?
I'm 27 right now.
27. Okay. And these students would be 16, 17, 18.
Right. Yeah.
You've been doing this for 3 years. You arrived in Baltimore as a Teach for America teacher, right?
Right. In 2009, I was placed in West Baltimore at Carver Vocational Technical High School. Mm-hmm. And I taught mostly 11th grade biology there.
And you and a couple of friends noticed something about the students.
Right.
What did you notice that got you into actually forming MERIT? Tell us how it came about.
Yeah, so I had two students who really inspired the idea for the program. The first student was named Trevor, and he came into my 11th grade biology class, like many of my students, really far behind academically. And in high school science, that means he didn't know what the heart did. He didn't know that our bodies were made of cells. He'd heard of DNA, but didn't really know why it was important. Because of that, he was pretty grumpy in biology class and actually told me the first week of school we'd get along if I let him sleep. And I said, we'll see about that. But a few months later, Tyron wrote one of the best essays comparing mitochondria and chloroplasts. He started staying during lunch and after school to make up his work. He got a 95% on our body systems exam and told me he wanted to become a doctor.
And how much time had elapsed? That was during the whole
About 3 months.
In those 3 months, what was that paper on, by the way? Say it again.
Mitochondria and chloroplasts.
And he got a 95.
Yeah.
So that perked you up. You said, wow, this kid has potential, obviously.
Exactly. And I learned from him and so many other students that I taught how much passion and potential our students in Baltimore have if they're given the appropriate experiences and resources.
Tyler, this is Trevor we're talking about.
Yeah.
What turned him on?
I think that he had had a string of science teachers growing up that used books or maybe just talked in front of the class, and he'd never seen science actually happen in front of him, and he'd never been challenged to think about why the world is the way it is and understand what's going on inside his body. So
how did you do it?
So in my class, every day we were doing a lot of hands-on activities and experiments, and students would actually see things happen in front of them, and then we'd start to question, why is that happening?
Not major surgery.
No.
But we did
dissect pigs. So
okay. So something physical, anyway.
Right,
and
yeah.
Not just lecturing and textbook.
Exactly, yeah.
So that was what year? That was 2009?
That was 2010. I taught.
So
him.
It's 2014. How's Trevor doing?
So he, and that year ended with the second highest score on the biology high school assessment, but his English and math skills were about seventh grade level. I tried to do some writing in my classroom also, but he graduated maybe with basic algebraic skills. He went on to community college at CCBC, and he had to take some remediation courses there. I met with him a couple months ago, and he finished his degree and is looking to go on to a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. So I'm kind of trying to help him get on his path still.
And you said there was another student similar who had a similar story that kind of inspired merit as well.
Yeah, so
right?
the second student was named David, and he came in my class limping one day, grabbing his knee, and I said, David, what's wrong? He's like, oh, don't worry about it. And I said, well, have you seen a doctor? And he said, I don't see doctors. And I asked him what he meant by that, and he told me the closest clinic he knew was two bus rides away, and his mother didn't have insurance, so his family just never saw doctors. And then I found it really interesting that I had a student who said, I want to be a doctor, sitting in the same classroom as a student who said, I don't see doctors. And this idea started forming, what if we can really find the students in the first group who are interested in this, support them academically and professionally and socially for the next few years, and get them two graduate degrees in health. Then they can come back to Baltimore and open a clinic next to David's house and make sure that everyone has access to healthcare.
That's a long what if, but that's the what if that you built merit on, right?
Right.
Medical Education Resources Initiative for Teens. Tyler Maines with us. Now, you had two associates from Teach for America who helped you with this, right?
Right, yeah. Mark Wilcox was a fellow Teach for America teacher with me, and then Sham Godwell was our program director, our kind of mentor coach.
Okay, and the idea was, let's get some volunteers, maybe some students from Hopkins professors from Hopkins or whoever you can find a volunteer to work with the kids on the weekends.
Yeah, exactly. So we started with teachers and started developing a curriculum, and we asked ourselves, what would it really take to actually transform Baltimore City High School students into healthcare leaders? And then we had a lot of work to do, and we were pretty successful. Our first year, even before we had students, we got into Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center with Dr. Rick Bennett being a huge champion of what we were doing. And he opened Bayview's doors and allowed our scholars to shadow their physicians in the hospital. And then we started working to develop a SAT prep curriculum, and we've just evolved over the past few years.
Wow. So, and that's been since 2010, 2011.
Right.
And am I right, Tyler, you've had about 30 or maybe more than 30 students now go through it?
Right, over 30 scholars. So over the past 4 years...
You're calling them scholars, the merit scholars.
Yeah.
Okay.
So over the past 4 years, we've been completely volunteer-run. So we've involved over 200 volunteers from all over Baltimore. So not just medical students and physicians from Hopkins, but University of Maryland, undergrad students from UMBC, several Meyerhoff scholars have participated as mentors from Goucher and Towson. We also have community members and parents who hear about us and want to help out.
Now, someone listening to this right now is thinking, Tyler Maines is involved with these kids. He's going to medical school. How is he? Wait a minute. How do you do that? How do you go to medical school and do this as well?
So I think that we have relied on our volunteers to do a lot of the programming, because in medical school, you know, I have to study and stuff and work in the hospital.
Yeah.
But we do, I mean, we do have time to do other things in the community, and this is how I chose to spend my time.
Okay. And how many volunteers have you had, say, what's your peak number of volunteers?
So overall, over the past 4 years, we've had over 200 volunteers.
Really?
And
not just teachers?
So we have Teach for America teachers, but medical students, physicians, people involved in the community in other ways.
So how do you identify the kids for this program? They're all high school students, right?
Right. So we only accept 10th graders, and we partner with the school system, Teach for America, Baltimore City Teaching Residency, College Bound, to work through the teachers and counselors, and their job at each school is to identify the 10th graders who would be strong fits for our program. And then they apply to merit. We review applications and then select about 50 students to attend a medical leadership course. And this is like a sports team tryout. And we see who comes on time, who texts during the sessions, how they interact with their peers, who does their homework. And from all that, we're really looking for the kids with the most passion and potential. And that's how we select our cohort.
And you end up with about 30 at a time, or how many?
So the past few years, we've selected 6 to 10 every year, but this year we're taking 20, so we're doubling. And then the next 2 years, I'd like to take 40.
Oh, I see. You've had more than 30 go through the program already.
Right.
In most years, 6 to 10, now up to 20.
Right.
You have 20 in the present year?
So right now we have 8 seniors, 10 juniors, and in a month we'll have 20 sophomores.
Wow, this is great. So let's see. What's the measure? It's maybe too early to tell. It's 2011, you started 2014. What can you tell us about the results so far?
So I can tell you last year, 100% of our seniors matriculated into four-year universities, and a third of them got full-ride scholarships. Our juniors increased their SAT scores by an average of 336 points, and the national average for a junior is 57 points.
National average
for a junior.
For improvement,
right?
You mean?
Yeah.
And your group averaged?
336 points.
Wow. That's impressive.
And I can also share some of our alum stories who are in college now.
Give us one example.
So our oldest alum, I'll say, her name's Jasmine. She's a junior at McDaniel College. She has a full ride scholarship she has a 3.4 GPA. She just completed an internship at Kennedy Krieger Institute and is planning to apply to PhD programs in clinical psychology next year to work specifically with children who've been exposed to trauma.
Do you have students who actually say, I want to be a doctor?
A lot of our students do. That's why they apply to merit. Another of our alums is a freshman at UNC Greensboro. She wants to be a family medicine doctor in Baltimore, and she's on track to earn a 4.0 GPA this semester.
Hmm. But the students have other interests in the general field of health sciences, right?
Right, yeah. So we have some students who want to be dentists, pharmacists, nurse practitioners.
What's the gender breakdown, Tyler, would you say, in the group you have this year?
So that's a good question and something I find really interesting. So we have 85% female, I'd say. We changed our recruitment strategy a little bit this year so that each school can submit a maximum of 3 male and 3 female applicants. So I'm hoping to get more male applicants. But as I've been looking at this whole landscape, there's a lot of research out there that female physicians, especially at academic hospitals, are not performing as well as their male counterparts, and males represent a majority of physicians overall.
What do you mean not performing as well?
In terms of getting promoted, there's a lot of additional challenges
okay.
for female physicians at academic hospitals, and people are starting to question why is that. So most of the leadership positions, for example, deans, the full professors, a lot of those are males.
I get you.
So somewhere along the line, we start with, in high school, so many females interested in the health sciences. And then somewhere, maybe in college or maybe it's beyond, males start to become more prevalent. And I wonder where that intersection is and what we can do to support everyone.
This is great, Tyler. Tyler, and props to you and your two colleagues, Mark and Sean.
Sean,
who got this thing rolling called Merit. Again, folks, it's Medical Education Resources Initiative for Teens, supporting high school students in Baltimore who want to pursue careers in health sciences, maybe even become doctors someday. We've been speaking with Tyler Maines, M-A-I-N-S, and we shared your Facebook page on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. What is the website for Merit?
It's meritbaltimore.org.
Very good. Well, congratulations on getting this rolling, and good luck to you, Tyler.
Thank you.
And good luck in medical school, too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up next, folks, Gather Baltimore. Gather Baltimore has distributed 500,000 pounds of food to Baltimore families. We'll catch up with the organization's very energetic founder, Arthur Morgan, when we return. And welcome back to Midday Friday, everyone. Today, we're speaking to people of undertaking creative projects to improve the lives of others. We just heard from Tyler Maines. Now we hear from Arthur Morgan. Catching up with Arthur, I call this segment, of Gather Baltimore. Arthur's Gather Baltimore, he founded that group. This is an all-volunteer organization that collects the food that farmers and restaurants are unable to sell, and he distributes them to low-income families who need this food in Baltimore City. And Arthur, nice to see you, first of all.
Thank you. I appreciate it
you
very
know,
much.
You know, first time we met you, you had
fellowship.
Open Society Institute fellowship a couple of years ago,
yep,
right?
Yep. That was 18 months, and then I'm out. I've been done 6 months. So
yeah,
that got me started.
So, Arthur had that fellowship from the OSI, and he came in that day and explained his project. So we ought to do a little bit of that today and see where you are 18 months later.
Growing pains.
Yeah.
Growing pains.
The idea was there's excess food, there's unsold food at farmers markets, there's baked goods, there's produce. What are we going to do with that, right?
That was the beginning. Now I'm in deeper water. I'm going to Jessup.
Uh-huh.
So Jessup.
To the wholesale food distribution center.
Which is, I don't know if people are familiar, but you're talking about warehouses. Warehouses the size of a football stadium full of one product. So you can imagine, you know, lots of different products. So I'm going to Jessup now. We purchased a refrigeration truck, and we also have a refrigeration truck that was donated. So now, instead of my pickup truck going to the farmers markets, I'm still doing that on Sundays, but during the week I go to Jessup with refrigeration trucks and 40,000 pounds at a pop
of all kinds of
everything,
produce, or
fruits, vegetables.
Okay,
everything.
Let's tell folks how it works, Arthur. Let's start with the simple idea was to go to. Well, keep your eye on the farmer's market, the downtown farmer's market specifically.
That was it. And the farmers.
And which one?
And the farmers, too, because besides the farmer's market, you know, afterwards we're going to go to their farms and glean their fields and get that food also. But that was a big focus was the farmers and the farmer's markets.
And then what did you do with it after that?
Then we just had to identify who needs food. And that's when it got really tricky because who doesn't need food? And when we thought about who are we trying to identify, people want to collect data, all that type of information, it became confusing because when you see a line of 500 people waiting for food, you just realize that they're people from everywhere. And basically everyone needs healthy food, and they need it to be affordable, and they need to have access to it.
Did you see a line of 500 people?
Last year there was a time when we had a line that went to one city block, turned and went down a city block, and then came back up a city block.
We should tell folks to describe it a little bit. You take your truck and you set up at a big tables.
We have tables. We always try and identify. We're mainly focused in Oliver neighborhood right now.
In East Baltimore,
and then we also do Penn Lucy. But we will identify a community group in that community that can identify some of the people, be a volunteer group that helps us load the truck, unload the truck, stay and work the farm stand, because if you've got 10, 12, 15 items, you want to put one person in each item that can help get that food into each bag. We go to IKEA and purchase IKEA bags, which are incredibly strong.
Those big blue bags.
Big butt blue bags.
Mm-hmm.
Each bag, 35 to 45 pounds on average of food. Most of the times you're seeing older people who can't even carry the bag. So it's kind of neat because you see the kids who are volunteering there who are helping the older people carry the food to their cars. The amount of food that's just being thrown away, and that's what's kind of disturbing, is everything. If I don't go and get it, they're just going to haul it away, throw it away, pay to get rid of it. And this is food, though, that, you know, I always tell the story at 11:59, it's for sale. 12 o'clock, it's getting thrown away. On a larger scale in Jessup, you're talking about tractor trailer loads of food.
Yeah, let's talk about Jessup. You mentioned Jessup at the beginning there. I wonder now, what is your approach to that? I understand the farmer's market. You wait around on Sunday, right, and take what's not sold.
I was in the right place at the right time.
How does it work?
I begged for a meeting with corporate people. Finally, when I got my foot in the door, it became even more serious, because if you tell someone that you're going to show up and get, you know, 20, 30,000 pounds of food and you don't show up, you've got one chance and that's it. They're done with you.
Because they don't really want to bother with it.
They don't want to mess with me.
Because otherwise, what would they be doing with all that food?
They're going to buy a truck. They're going to buy a dumpster. They're going to hire a driver. They're going to pay a driver to haul that food to a dump site in Delaware, pay dump fees, drive it back.
All right. What's the condition of the food at that point?
Excellent.
Still good.
Yes. They're just making room.
Arthur, tell us what you're talking about. Lettuce?
Everything.
Everything. Tomatoes?
Papayas, apples, oranges. I mean, it's incredible. This is everything that you see in a grocery store comes from Jessup. That's just where they put it there, they sort it out, then they deliver it to the other stores.
Okay. So what you're getting is what's left over that didn't go to supermarkets?
Excess. Last year, there was a guy that showed up. He actually brought a tractor trailer load of butternut squash to the wrong facility, unhooked his tractor trailer, and left. 20-some thousand pounds of just butternut squash that'll last, you know, 6 months or a year. And he was gone down the road. And they called me and said, come get it.
Now, you mentioned this earlier when we got started a few minutes ago. What is your capacity? How did you increase your capacity to haul that stuff? You said you had a refrigeration truck?
I definitely went and talked with my partners in Jessup, and they have a fleet of over 200 trucks. I said, is there any way you could help us with an older used truck, something you're looking to get rid of? So they actually helped us get a very, very affordable truck. It had been used. They kind of donated it, but then we still had to pay to get it serviced, get it back on the road. I mean, still spent about $5,000 or $10,000 just to get it, you know, where it would run and pass inspection. Then we accumulated some funds, which actually I spent my OSI money to buy a refrigeration truck that was used, but, you know, even a used refrigeration
truck.
What
did it cost you?
The used one was about
$30,000. $30,000, all right. And that's half of your OSI fellowship, right?
That was gone.
Okay.
And then about 10 for the used one that they donated, and insurance, fuel, tires.
So you have two?
Yes, we have two trucks now.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And what do you do with that food?
So now we're back to the Gather Baltimore store.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening.
And where is that?
So that is Mill Valley General Store. We're starting to partner with them now. That is where I have also my walk-in refrigerators. So now, before, I would just go get a truckload of food. I'd have to take it really quick, take it to a site, unload it, get rid of it. Now I can just go to Jessup several times a week, go back to our warehouse, Mill Valley, unload, put it in our walk-ins, sort it, separate it, bag it, deal with other organizations now. Now we're reaching out to everyone throughout the city, different organizations.
That will
help us distribute it, because I just can't do it all.
I understand.
I can only do so many farm stands and so many markets. So now with the Gather Baltimore store, people Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, while the store is open, we'll have walk-in refrigeration where people can come and pick the bags up. Organizations could also set in where we'll have orders where you can pick up, like, say you want to do 50 bags at a time, whether it's assisted living, some of these high-rises, churches, any group of need will be able to come and get food. And it's usually $6 for a bag. We ask for a donation. No one is turned away. If you do not have food, we're still going to give you the bag.
If you do not have money.
If you don't have money,
yeah,
you still get food.
It's unconditional.
It's unconditional.
I mean, the $6 you say is a donation.
We ask for
$6. But you don't ask people.
If you don't have it.
You don't look at what kind of car they drove to get there.
It's hard because someone.
You don't do any of that stuff, do you?
People used to, but then there was a real serious issue. When you think about, like, on Sunday, don't you usually put on your really, really good clothes and drive your really, really nice car when we're dealing, that's kind of a weird way to say it, but the people that were coming to get the food were usually coming after church.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to identify someone exactly by their appearances.
So what were you going to do anyway? You're going to challenge somebody about whether they should be entitled to free food if they're there for it? You don't do that, do you?
I don't. In the beginning, you're always going to have one person in the crowd. There's always going to be difficult situations, but you have to just deal with it, go with it. And we've figured out now that even when you're in the line and you have a line of a couple hundred people, if someone doesn't have food, we're going to give it to them. But you usually see the person behind them or in front of them will say, hey, I've got a couple of dollars. I can chip in or something like that. Mm-hmm. Part of our program, too, is though no matter what, 10% out of everything, or, you know, for every 10 bags we get rid of, one bag we make sure we give away. So no matter what, you know, we're going to address the fact that there are people who have nothing. You know, people come up to me every day in the line will have $2 or $3 in change. And I mean change, not even quarters, but change. And I'm like, are you sure you can handle this? And they're like, yeah, I want you to have something. Hmm. I know you need fuel. I know you need to keep doing this. So
could you talk about this a little bit? We've spoken on this show with experts about obesity, you know, health.
Everything.
Health experts.
Exactly.
Doctors, dietitians about the obesity problem, public health officials.
Yes.
In Baltimore City and its association with low-income people.
Yes.
I wonder, 18 months into Gather Baltimore, what have you learned about that, about people's eating habits and their desire? Actually, it sounds like there's lots of desire to have fresh food. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's hard for me to identify or how to really talk about it clearly because I don't really understand it. I mean, no matter how much money you make, there's still people who are overweight or don't eat what they should eat. You know, some people are just working all the time and don't have time, supposedly, to eat good. We have people who are from all walks of life who come to our stands who just say, this is a chance when I can get very, very good food and it's such an affordable price. I'll have people that will come up and buy 10 or 20 bags and only take one and say, hey, I just want to make sure some other people have some bags. So people who are doing well come to the stand, too. People who aren't doing well. There's a lot of different things, and that's I kind of wrote down there with the Hopkins School of Health. I'm starting to form partnerships now with different groups who can identify these things better than me.
Mm-hmm.
I can go get the food.
Right,
I
you
can
go get it. Right, you want.
I'm not the data.
You
man.
Need some help getting it to people in the neighborhoods who really need it. Right, and so you've also recognized. I guess that's why you got into this. You don't want to see food being wasted,
it's
but also there aren't enough supermarkets. There isn't enough access to food.
They keep closing them down, right in Oliver, everywhere. I mean, I just keep seeing the doors shut down. I don't know the reasons why. I don't know that.
You mean stores that were selling fresh produce?
Oh, heck yeah. There were grocery stores that were just halfway okay, selling something, but they just don't seem to do that well, or I don't know. Those things are beyond my understanding.
Okay.
I just am also on the backside now. Before, I wanted to help the farmers even more. Now, when I go to Jessup, and we're talking about global environmental issues when you see this kind of waste.
You know, what I was getting at before is that if you don't have access to fresh food all the time, you eat a lot of prepared food, you eat stuff that maybe isn't that quite that healthy but does satisfy you, it fills the need because you're hungry. And the idea that you're bringing fresh fruit and vegetables to people...
Yes.
Suggests there is a desire for that and recognition that that's good for you.
What did you eat today?
Yeah. Huh?
What did you eat today?
I haven't had much so far.
And me either. You know, sometimes when you're so busy.
What did I have?
It's hard to make the time, but
I had,
you feel
some eggs this morning. Yeah.
I mean, you feel better when you eat better.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it affects everything.
We have a call for you, Arthur Morgan. This is Lisa. Lisa, what's your last name? Welcome to the show.
It's O'Reilly.
Lisa O'Reilly with the York Road Partnership. Is that right?
That's right, yes. I'm on the leadership of the York Road Partnership. And Arthur and Gather Baltimore came to the partnership about maybe a year ago and asked us as a community organization would we help with volunteering for Gather Baltimore. And there's a number of people stepped up and said yes. And it's been incredible. It's just been amazing. Down in Penlucy, just opposite Walter P. Carter, and just in the last year, there's been a number of new families have been resettled there who are refugees from Congo and from Rwanda. And they're just amazed they can get fresh food because it's bringing up the whole point, and I think you've just raised it too. If you don't have a car, you won't get fresh food, especially in that area. It's a huge food desert. So what you're doing, Arthur, is amazing. Thank you so much.
Everybody.
Sincerely hope other people begin to realize that we have to do it ourselves because nobody else is going to do it for us.
It's everybody, though. I mean, I'm sure.
Thank you, Lisa. Yeah.
The volunteers. It's not me. It's the people that show up, the people that unload the truck, the volunteers. It's just everything.
Arthur, it's Friday. So what do you do? What is your routine today? I'm just curious. How are you going to spend the day?
Well, I'm waiting. was in a ditch this morning doing a sewer line with my dad, but okay. Now I'm getting ready to go hop in the refrigeration truck and head out to Jessup. And not to make it a bad way, but I'm headed to Jessup to get food. We'll be making bags this weekend.
Making bags at Mill Valley.
Yep.
And people can pick them up there, or organizations can pick them up there.
Right now, we are dealing with setting the organizations up. I say in January, we'll be full swing with the actual store. Right now, that's the place of where we create the bags.
Okay.
And as of January, that's when I think I'd feel more comfortable saying that we're...
Come and get it.
Yes.
All right, I get you. That Mill Valley is right here on Assistant Street.
28th and Assistant
Street.
Right,
okay.
Yep.
And Arthur, again, we're speaking with Arthur Gray Morgan. His organization is Gather Baltimore. He's been talking about the Gather Baltimore store. Sounds like it'll be online next month.
We'll be posting, letting everybody know kind of what's going on.
Now, you have a Kickstarter campaign specifically to keep...
Just help out right now.
For the maintenance of the trucks.
Now that we've been going for a couple of years, we do have some foundations that help us, but we started a small Kickstarter campaign that just help us with some general costs. And, just alone last year, I think we spent $17,000 in fuel. You know, it's just unreal. It's so expensive. It's crazy. So.
But still, Arthur, you're doing a great thing here. So
everybody is. It's not just me.
And you have a lot of volunteers.
That's the biggest thing. I want to make sure I thank everyone who's ever donated, volunteer, everybody who shows up.
You going to hit the farmer's market on Sunday?
It's pretty thin down there right now.
It's the end of the season.
It's the very, very end. I'll probably go just to see the last one and walk around. But if there's anything there, we'll definitely get it.
Okay. Because you get baked goods as well, too, don't you?
Anything.
Yeah. Okay, Arthur Morgan, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The last farmer's market downtown is Sunday. The farmer's market in Waverly, I think, continues
all
year.
Year-round. Yep.
Yeah. All right, Arthur, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank
Congratulations
you,
everybody. To you, and good work.
Thank you.
More information about Gather Baltimore is simply gatherbaltimore.org, and there is a link there to their Kickstarter campaign. Another break here on Midday. When we come back, how do you create portraits of women in prison when you aren't allowed to take their pictures? Multimedia artist Lynn Casaubon joins us after this short break. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. This hour, we've been talking to people who working on creative projects to reach out to underserved people in our area. We heard from Tyler Maines, that medical student, helping Baltimore high school students consider careers in healthcare and actually pursue careers in healthcare. And that was Arthur Morgan from Gather Baltimore, doing some great stuff there, gathering food that would otherwise go to waste and getting it to families who need it. Now we meet Lynn Casaubon. Lynn Casaubon is an associate professor in art at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And she joins us to talk about her project with incarcerated women at the Maryland Correctional Institute in Jessup, the Institute for Women there. Lynn, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. This is a really interesting project you have going here. I heard about, a few years ago, the Maryland Green Prisons Initiative. So I knew about this work here. This is to try to actually train some inmates in horticulture, right?
Yes.
In a way, right? So why don't we start there? Let's talk about that project, because your project grew out of that, right?
Yeah. The Maryland Green Prison Initiative is an initiative that's led by a guy named Bill Merritt at the Department of Correctional. It's a long acronym.
It's a long name.
Yeah.
It's the Department of Corrections.
Yeah. So he has coordinated a bunch of different programs in the prison system across Maryland to train inmates to help with ecological research, also to do organic farm gardening. And it actually is all modeled on this program called Sustainability in Prisons. And it started in Washington State at Evergreen College. And actually, there's a lot of states now that have these initiatives going on, trying to get inmates to learn about gardening and start actually maybe producing food.
So how did you hear about it?
Through my colleague, Chris Swan, who's an ecologist at UMBC, and he started working with the inmates to help, to train them to help with his research, and also a PhD student of his named Anna Johnson. So he kind of invited me in. Chris and I have been working together in various ways, and he invited me in to do something at the prison. I had no idea what I was going to do.
You're an artist, a multimedia artist.
Yes.
You're a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
So he invited you in.
Come
down and see what the women are doing at the prison?
Well, at my previous work, I've been working with herbaceous plants as a subject matter. Actually, weeds was a previous project. So
you've taken pictures of weeds,
yes,
haven't you?
Yes,
yeah.
I have this whole.
So I've seen them. Some pretty interesting pictures of weeds.
Thank you.
Okay.
So he, you know, he knew my work before. And you know, his idea about me working with them, I think, you know, he had no idea what I might do. Maybe make some labels, help them draw labels for the vegetable garden. But anyway, I came with this idea that I really wanted to create portraits of these women. So there was a group of women that they were training, started off as a group about 13 or 14, and now it's at 11. And I wanted to create portraits of them. But then I quickly learned, you know, I can't take photographs of the women directly because of privacy issues. So I came up with this kind of workaround, which actually in the end is much more satisfying for me creatively. So,
as I understand it, the Portrait Garden Project, mm-hmm, at the Maryland's prison, the women's prison at Jessup, mm-hmm, women build, design, maintain gardens, and within the garden there are certain plants that they maybe self-identify with. Is that what you wanted them to do?
Yes.
And you challenged them, mm-hmm, to do that?
Yes. Yeah. So we started in 2013. I approached them with my idea that I wanted them to select perennial plants specifically to represent themselves. And the women were excited right away, and they got the metaphorical reference of, like, how do you choose a plant
to represent yourself? It's something I've never thought of. Have you ever thought of that?
Oh, yes.
You have.
I have. Yes. Yes.
If you were a plant, what kind of plant would you be? I mean, it sounds corny, but so you have to really, really think about that.
And know the plant, its growth habit, what it looks like, its color, et cetera. So that's a lot of the conversations I had with the women, and also talking to them about perennials in particular.
And they immediately got it. They were excited by the idea?
They did get it. And then gave them some time, gave them lots of materials on plants, allowed them time to make a selection. I'd also had to base it on plant availability, what would do well in the prison too, because I, you know, came to them saying, we're going to make some gardens here, and where are we going to put them? We ended up making three in the end. It's a harsh environment, as you can imagine, in the prison. So like in the sun gardens, there's absolutely no shade whatsoever. The soil is poor. So we had to consider that as well in terms of which plants they could select from. They had to be hardy plants, really.
Mm-hmm. There's a long criteria there. And
yes,
from that, they still had to think in terms of themselves, their own personality, who, mm-hmm, they are in life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Some of the women you dealt with are serving life sentences, correct?
Yes. Yes, they are.
Now, so that's one aspect of the project, is the actual selection of a plant, mm-hmm, and the building of the gardens. And you took photographs of these gardens and, mm-hmm, these plants.
Mm-hmm.
But you also interviewed the women.
Yes, I did, yeah.
So how did that go over? How did you...
From the start, I told them, I want you to be able to articulate why did you choose a particular plant over another, and talk to me about that choice, as well as I want to hear about their past experiences with garden, before they were incarcerated. What were their experiences? And so that's where the interviews came from. So I did those interviews actually just before we created the gardens last year.
We're going to listen to excerpts of a couple of those interviews.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to ask you, as a multimedia artist and someone who teaches art, what did you get out of this, you personally? Did you feel you were helping these women to think beyond planting gardens and maintaining gardens? Did you feel you were reaching inside them?
Yes, I did, actually. I felt like I really started the project kind of just conceptually just wondering, what would I feel like if I were facing a life term sentence? How would I continue to get up in the morning and evolve as a person? And so that's sort of the question I came to them with. And I do feel that the women really, when I was speaking to them, really did that. And I think the whole exercise of trying to identify yourself with a plant kind of was the kind of impetus behind that, the catalyst, mm-hmm, that got them thinking about themselves in a sort of reflective way.
Well, let's listen to one of these. This is Wendy, a prisoner in Jessup. She talks about why she chose a daylily for her portrait.
I chose the daylily in part because the daylily represents a lot of who I am. The fact that the plant will bloom, and its bloom lasts only one day, but it has multiple blooms, so there's usually a bloom every day. But I relate that to me in that a lot of my incarceration has to do with my battles of mental illness. So there's a lot of myself that I'm not happy with, that I don't like, that I have tried to overcome. And I picture myself sometimes as a flower, and I'm in bloom at times, but then there are parts of me that I want to pinch off and get rid of. And so as the daylily bloom closes up and dies off, it makes room for additional blooms. So I look at that and compare it to my life in such a way that as I am growing, I am pinching away some of the dead, ugly parts that I don't like about me, and it is opening windows and doors for me to bloom and become more of who I want to be, more the pretty plant than the dead one.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Must have made you appreciate what it's like to be in prison. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about Wendy's situation, how long she faces in prison.
She's
there for a long
11
time.
11 years. She's 11 not years? Life sentence, but I think.
Okay,
I think
but still. Yeah. To go from day to day and think in terms of growing,
right?
Think in terms of improving in some way. When that's 11 years. I don't know when she's due for parole or anything, but still, even 2 or 3 years, that's a long time to face in the prison. Well, that's remarkable. As women, I have found as a reporter going into prison to talk to inmates that they're very eager to speak to you, tell you their stories, to open up. In my case, it's usually an inmate has written to me at the Baltimore Sun. They want me to come and interview them about a grievance they have or some issue. Mm-hmm. What about in your case? Did they open up to you right away? It sounds like they understood what you wanted to accomplish with the project.
Mm-hmm. It varied a little bit. There's some women that were not as talkative. You can see that reflected in the interviews, that there's some that are 3 minutes and some that are 20 minutes. So there's some that wanted to talk to me more than others, or were more kind of poised to open up in a certain way. Wendy was certainly one of those, I think, because of her, like she said, the history of mental illness and her experiences with therapy in prison. She's sort of already self-reflecting, you know. So,
how about Elsa? Can we talk about her a little bit before we listen to her? What can you tell us about her that you're able to say?
Okay. Well, Elsa has she's an interesting woman in terms of, you know, not, and she talks about this in her interview, coming from a kind of normal, mainstream life, and then ending up in prison. And she had experience as a docent with the, in Washington, D.C., the National Arboretum. I mean, a real wide variety of experience that you wouldn't think a person in prison would have.
Mm-hmm.
Highly educated, articulate, and, so, I mean, there's a lot of stuff I can't really say about her in particular, when I met her, it was like, wow, what are you doing here? You know, kind of thing. I think that's one of the experiences I had with a lot of these women in terms of my preconceived ideas about who was in prison, but every single one I met kind of overturned that assumptions that I might have carried with me.
Here's Elsa talking about what growing a garden means to someone living in prison.
There's a connection between growing things in a garden and life and the diversity of life. For a prisoner especially, having an opportunity to watch life continue and explore the diversity in it is extremely positive and almost a spiritual kind of thing, maybe a energy-producing concept. I chose plants that struck me as being unusual and having lovely colors that were outside of the regular rainbow of plant colors like pink, white, yellow, green, because I think it's of significance to all of us to recognize that there's more to life than just the obvious, and what we see may not always be all there is, and what we understand is never all that is possible to understand.
Hmm. Lynn Casaubon is our guest. This is her project, the Portrait Garden at the Maryland Women's Prison in Jessup, and that was a woman named Elsa, who's a prisoner there, speaking. Elsa, do you know what her plant was? Do you remember?
She chose Heuchera for one of her plants. Heuchera is the photograph I took, it's a very dark leafed plant. The particular cultivar she chose, kind of not your mainstream kind of plant. It is actually a native plant that she selected. I chose plants for them as well. I didn't say this, but they chose plants, and I chose a plant for them. In the case of the women who are nine of the 11, I chose a native plant to accompany whatever they chose.
And what did you base your choices on?
The conversations I had with them. Just sort of gut feeling about who they are.
By the way, you couldn't take photographs of the women in prison,
right?
First, without their permission. Secondly, and it's very complicated in the state of Maryland, you have to get the permission of their victims,
right?
Families, their next of kin of their victims, mm-hmm. to take photographs, even to interview them, I believe, right?
Not to interview them,
but to get photographs.
Just to get the photographs, yeah. And also in terms of the agreement I made that their full names are not used in my project. That had to do with the victims, yeah.
But there are photographs that came out of this,
yes.
And they're beautiful from what I've seen.
Thank you.
I need to get on a light rail train to see the rest of them. Okay, so let's explain that. You have an installation that's on, mm-hmm. the Baltimore light rail system.
Yes. So what I wanted to do was to disseminate the project in the public in the city of Baltimore. So I came with this idea to do these posters in the light rail system. Fortunately, I got a grant through the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance to realize that. So right now, for the month of December, there's 100 posters riding around in 13 car trains on the light rail. And the posters have a photograph, the flower or plant that represents the woman, a short text of a quote from the interview, and then a QR code. So you can scan your phone, your mobile device, and then hear the woman speaking on your phone. That's the idea. I only wish that the light rail had Wi-Fi.
Right.
Make it even easier, but you can do
it. I think that's great. Whose idea was that, by the way? Is light rail trying to open up the trains to art, or was it the Cultural Alliance's idea?
It's my idea.
It's all you, Lynn. It's all you. I don't have to defer to somebody else. This was all your idea.
It's not my idea. I used my grant money to pay for it. The company that rents that space, and they did actually cut us a little deal because I'm, nonprofit, et cetera. But
Both of those interviews we listened to, I got a lot out of it. I found Wendy's comments really remarkable. Was there a particular moment for you in this project when you thought, "Yeah, this is why I live. This is why I'm an artist. This is why I do what I do"?
Well, actually, Wendy's interview was amazing. It was a great interview, I have to say. But they all touched me in terms of particulars of their situation.
So, Lynn, the posters are on the train. The
yes.
trains are moving, and you have a moving permanent exhibit for the month of December. Can
yes.
we say that? All right.
Yes.
Called the Portrait Gardens.
Hmm? Portrait Garden. It's a metaphorical garden.
Right. We get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Good. And the women, they all know that about their plants are out there on the train.
Actually, I'm going to have an exhibition of the project in the prison for them. The plan was to have it overlap with the light rail, but actually, I got pneumonia just before Thanksgiving. So that's been delayed. It'll be put up at the end of January in the prison. So, and I intend to give copies of the pictures to the women. The women also did some artwork themselves on the gardens, so that'll also be part of that exhibition in the prison.
Are you happy with this?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you should be. Well, good work,
Lynn.
Thank you. It was nice to meet you.
Great to meet you.
Yeah, yeah. Congratulations on the project Portrait Gardens that you can find on the light rail. So all aboard and check out Lynn's photographs from this project.
And the website, too.
And I have that on our Facebook page. Lynn, on your website?
Portraitgarden.org.
Oh, I haven't seen that. Okay, I've seen your website.
Okay.
But I'll go to portraitgarden.org to see more of this.
That has
okay.
the total, all the interviews, all the photographs.
Oh, we got to get that up there. I got to see that. All right. And I really did like your photograph of the weeds, especially the one of a plant that's inside a window and a weed that's immediately outside the window, and they're kind of like looking at each other. That's a great photograph.
Thank you.
Lynn, thank you very much. Lynn Casabon. That's our first hour of Midday, folks. I hope you enjoyed it. We're going to take a break here for lunch. Please have a slice of pizza, Lynn, from Joe's Squared Pizza at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood. JoeSquared.com for more information. Stay tuned for the news, and we'll see you for the second hour.